Go on to the second case of the day, and that is Parkland Environmental Group versus Laborers International Union of North America, Laborers Local 477. It's number 092895. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Bruce Mills, and I represent Parkland Environmental. And what we're looking at here is a case where the district court affirmed by a summary judgment a decision by an arbitration body. And first, concerning the summary judgment issue, remembering summary judgment 101, there are disputed material facts in this case. And in fact, she pointed that out in her opinion. The dispute here is that Parkland went to the union because he needed some extra employees, the union, and he said he wanted it on a project basis. And the union then said, okay. They finished one project. Then he signed another agreement for the second project, assuming that it was for the length of the project only, which is what the first one was.
What do you mean, assuming?
He essentially said that, you know, I only want this to be a project only.
Now, he didn't read the contract, did he?
He didn't read the contract, no.
Now, the first one was only one page, and that was...
Well, the first one is a one-page letter of assent which ties the employer to the thick contract. So, in essence, it's the same thing.
Well, look, the White Oaks Mall Project, thank you. That agreement, which everyone agrees was a project-only agreement,
yes.
That's a one-page agreement. Whereas the CBA for the Washington Street project was 49 pages. I mean, in my head, that discrepancy alone would signal that the Washington Street agreement was different in kind from the White Oaks one.
Well, if you look at that letter of assent he signed for the White Oaks contract, it says that that Parkland agrees to follow all of the terms and conditions in the thick contract. They just didn't. A lot of times unions will just have people sign a letter of assent and that ties them to the other. That's regular standard operating procedure. But Mr. Stowers thought that the second one, and he says that he had conversations with the union that the second one would be project only too, and he acted on that basis. And so once the second project, the Washington Street project, was completed, he had no further contact with the union until he received a grievance from them 2 years later. And then when he got this grievance, he immediately said, "You have no jurisdiction over me. There is no collective bargaining agreement." And they proceeded, and he went to the arbitration hearing only to affirm his jurisdictional status, saying, "I don't have a collective bargaining agreement." But in this case, they went ahead and held a unilateral arbitration. And I point out a Fifth Circuit case in which... the union here, instead of having a unilateral arbitration, they should have gone to court and compelled Parkland to either arbitrate it or not arbitrate it. That was a question for the courts to make. But they went ahead and held it unilaterally. And secondly, the first grievance says that Parkland is a signatory to this agreement, and whether or not a company has agreed to arbitrate is a matter of contract, and again, that needs to go be decided through the courts. It goes back through various Supreme Court cases in which the Supreme Court says a matter of arbitrability is to be decided by the courts. But they didn't do that. They held this unilateral arbitration. And
is the letter in your appendix, is that the July 18th, 2006 letter where they start out saying a meeting of the
yes.
About the letters, and it's, it says you are a signatory and your company is directed, and said after considering testimony and evidence offered by both the union and your company.
Well, the company offered no evidence other than to say this is a jurisdictional dispute. There is no collective bargaining agreement.
On that point, counsel, when counsel made the representation as to whether or not the arbitration had jurisdiction.
Yes.
Maintaining that objection, he could have still participated in an arbitration, correct?
And maintained the jurisdictional argument.
Yes, sir.
And
he chose not to.
Yeah, he chose not to. The only other one was this one particular project, or two, I think, in Springfield. And the union took evidence from the union, and he had two people work 4 days, and the union said it would have taken four people to do this job, which is curious in itself.
You know, I'm going to go back a bit, because you repeatedly argue that there was no CBA in place, but you don't dispute that it's Mr. Stower's signature on the CBA, and the CBA contains an arbitration clause.
Well, that's,
isn't that all that matters?
Now, that's a... Well, there's two sides to this. That's a factual dispute as to whether or not Mr. Stower signed this with the knowledge that it was for the Washington Street project only. And
he signed it.
He did sign it. He thought it was just for the Washington Street project.
Does that put him in some kind of special position that he doesn't read what he signs?
It does, and that's an issue that needs to be raised. It's not this issue, but they typically a guy will be working on a job site, and they say you have to be a signatory, and they'll hand somebody a contract this thick and say you got to sign this. Well, that's in fact
where would we be if that was the law? I mean, everyone would come in here and say it was this thick. I didn't know what I was signing.
Yeah. Well, that's
you're going to ruin our lives.
that's another issue, and actually, Congress and the President are taking up these long discussions of credit issues. But in fact, the union cites a case, which obviously the where I turned it now wouldn't pop up, in which it says it quotes this court by saying carefully written, well-reasoned, and thoroughly negotiated contracts are presumptively complete. There was no negotiation. This contract was negotiated by the Southern Illinois Builders Council, of which Parkland was not a member. And the arbitration committee consisted of six people, three from the Southern Illinois Builders Council, three from the union. And that's inherently biased. I'm not raising that matter here, but you know, typically you choose a panel of arbitrators and you scratch one until you come up with another. But this one, a third party, which has nothing to do with Parkland or the union, is sitting in as arbitrators. And again, he could have read this, but I think that's asking a lot. Now, there's some other issue, another issue in which the Supreme Court has said that for where Section 301, which is where this is brought, has a 6 month standard of limitations, so that from the time, and there's a series of cases beginning with A&L Underground, which is an NLRB case, was saying that after the union knew or should have known, and simply lack of response is should have known, that after 6 months, the contract is null and void. And that's exactly what happened in this case. They finished the Washington Street project. 2 years later, they get this contract, or they get this grievance, and it's long been since the contract had been made null and void by the statute of limitations, which was set forth by the Supreme Court. Now, just one other thing before I bail on this part is that they said in hybrid cases, and this is a hybrid case, it could have been brought under Section 301 or Section 885. In fact, I just got an opinion last week written by Judge Mannion, in which he said that it was...
He didn't read that one either. Right?
Pardon?
He didn't read that contract
either. No, I keep getting these secondhand after that's been decided. But this is a hybrid. It could have gone under 885, but I'll say now, a well-reasoned opinion. That's what Judge Mannion decided before. So I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Okay, Mr. Long.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court? Your Honor, my name is John Long, and I represent Labor's Local 477, the appellee in this case. To save time, I'm not going to go over the facts because I think the facts are very straightforward.
And we read them.
And you read them, that's right. The facts are there was a contract, there was an agreement signed, there was a grievance, then there was an arbitration. Before we get into substantive arguments, I think it's important to first realize the standard of review in this case. The standard of review is de novo because it's the entrance of a summary judgment motion. However, it's a summary judgment motion confirming an arbitration award and denying a petition to vacate. And as such, this Court has repeatedly recognized that its role is that of a gatekeeper to make the threshold decision of arbitrability rather than get entangled into the merits of the dispute. And I think from the argument today, one of the initial arguments that Parkland is making about the project nature of the agreement is just that. It's one of those core disputes that was resolved by the arbitrator. So I think that's important to realize that this Court's role is to determine whether or not there was an agreement to arbitrate rather than get entangled in the disputes.
Well, Mr. Mills wants to give us more work, and you want to give us none.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a good balance. Turning to Local 477's position, we think this case falls within the nearly 40 years of jurisprudence about the presumption of arbitrability and the policy favoring labor arbitrations. The most recent of which is the United Steel case that this Court decided a few years back. And we think it fits squarely into that because what we really have here is a dispute over the scope of the agreement.
Well, was Parkland's participation in the arbitration a limited one such that the arbitrator never heard any arguments, that the CBA was a project-only agreement, or that laborers should not be allowed to enforce the CBA because it waited too long?
Good question. And I think Justice Mannion picked up on that. If you look at the arbitration award itself, their position falls apart. Because if you look at the arbitration award itself, the second aspect of that decision, it specifically indicates, as the judge picked up, that Parkland made an argument that two people did the work, and the union had an estimate of four people that did the work. That shows quite clearly that Parkland did not just appear to contest the arbitrability of the issue. But I think, as Your Honor pointed out as well, they could have argued arbitrability and continued to argue the merits of this dispute and at the same time preserved that issue for the court. And I think that's exactly what they did. But I think the arbitration award itself destroys their argument in that regard. Also, if you look at the record, David Stower's deposition, which exists at page 226 of the, I'm sorry, Your Honor, it's not 226, It's his deposition where he indicates that he...
What page?
Let's see. It's at 219, where during a deposition I asked him at the top, page 38, it says, at that hearing, the subject of that hearing was the grievance, was it not? Yes, he responds. Okay, and you presented arguments at that hearing. Isn't that right? Yes. Okay, you claimed, among other things, probably that you weren't signatory to the agreement. Isn't that right? That's true, yes. So they clearly admit that they raised other arguments at the arbitration. And the union...
Oh, I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
The union clearly did not unilaterally proceed with an arbitration.
Did Parkland engage in other work that violated the CBA between the Washington Street project and the ones that formed the basis for this action?
Not to the knowledge of the local union, and we indicate that in our response, that factually their repudiation argument, first and foremost, is absolutely unequivocally waived because it was never raised in any way, shape, or form in the district court. But subject to that, in addition to being based on improper board decisions, the union's position consistently has been that they were not aware of any other projects between the time period of the White Oaks Mall, or excuse me, the Washington Street project, and then the Springfield Housing Authority project and the Furrows project.
Does the union have any kind of method by which they, on a regular basis, monitor the signatories to see if they are providing services that they're not?
The union has. They have field representatives. They have job stewards that all monitor those situations. Parkland, interestingly, is more along the lines of a subcontractor that performs asbestos abatement, and so frequently those are monitored through general contractors that are also signatory to the laborers. But I think
they turn them in, or that's how they find them.
That's right.
Somebody says this, other people that are working for other subs will spot them. So there's way different ways to reveal that non-union kind of sub is working there.
That's right. And but going back to this repudiation argument and statute of limitations argument, I think it's absolutely clear it was waived. There's no question about it. And Parkland's reference to the record does not illustrate that they preserved this issue. But if you actually get into the repudiation argument, it is absolutely meritless. Absolutely meritorious for several reasons. First of all, the repudiation in the airline case, Airline versus Moffitt, and the United Steel case, this court said that attempts to avoid or rescind an agreement is for the arbitrator to decide. And that's on page 16 of our brief. It's for the arbitrator to decide that issue. Secondly, this concept of repudiation, Parkland repudiating the agreement. Therefore, since we didn't do anything with 6 months and applying a statute of limitations to that grievance, improperly confuses 301 law under the Labor Management Relations Act and the unfair labor practice remedy with the National Labor Relations Board. Specifically, what the board decisions quoted, starting with A&L Underground, are basically the local union would be precluded from asserting an unfair labor practice, and the National Labor Relations Board would not enter an order demanding that Parkland bargain and continue to bargain in good faith. That's all that stands for. This court, and I think it was the Sinecraft case, which goes back probably 20 years, specifically created a distinction and said that you have 301 remedies and you have unfair labor practice type remedies, and they're not exclusive of each other. And what Parkland has done is they've bootstrapped that statute of limitations that applies to an unfair labor practice charge and tried to say that it applies in this circumstance, when clearly Supreme Court law has said that procedural infirmities or procedural defenses, procedural arbitrability, is for the arbitrator to decide. I'm not sure where I stand in my time. I don't think I've seen the white light yet. But I want to, before I run out of time, I want to really emphasize the fact that this case really falls squarely into the United Steel case. I think you summed it up best when you said, isn't that all that's needed? The agreement was signed by David Stauer. The parties are presumed to be equal. The parties are presumed to understand what they sign, and they're bound by what they sign. To rule otherwise would take so many steps back in labor arbitration procedures that it would literally throw everything into chaos. And I don't say that dramatically. But I think this case squarely fits in the United Steel case. Both cases involved a dispute over the scope of the agreement. Both cases involved a dispute regarding the effect of a side letter agreement or a side agreement, oral agreement on the core contract. And this court has previously several times indicated that is for the arbitrator to decide. And these other issues regarding 8F, 9A distinctions, and this contract is really a void contract, I think that was properly addressed by the district court in the Buckeye decision. It was dispositive because that wasn't addressed to the arbitration clause itself. But turning to really focus on Parkland's arguments in this case, I think it's important to realize that this court has warned litigants, if you're going to appeal an arbitration decision, you better not make frivolous arguments, whether they be motivated in whole or in part, frivolous or meritless or substantially without merit. Unlike anything I've seen, this court has gone through significant efforts to point that out to litigants, starting, I think, with the Norfolk case in 1987. So it's not new law. And most recently, I think it was the Kuna case where this court said, take heed of this, lawyers. Take heed of this high standard we have imposed. And if you look at Parkland's arguments, their primary arguments that they argued today were raised for the first time on appeal. If you consider the timing of the arguments, two of the primary arguments were raised in their brief before this court. That's the repudiation and statute of limitations argument. But even in the reply, which was filed several weeks ago, they continue to raise new arguments that were not raised whatsoever in the trial court. They argue bias. They argue this concept of a unilateral arbitration. Never before were those raised. And the timing of raising those arguments, I think, speaks volumes to the fact that they're meritless and that they were waived and that this court should not be burdened with these arguments at this late in the game. They had the forum. They had the opportunity to do so at the district court, and they clearly did not do so. In addition, if you consider the fact that they, especially with respect to the United Steel case, they took the what this court has referred to as the ostrich posture or ostrich approach, which was they failed to distinguish or attempt to distinguish the United Steel case. They failed to argue that it should be overturned. The first time they addressed the United Steel case, Your Honors, was in their reply. And that was after we pointed out in our brief the fact that here's a clearly applicable case that the district court at least found was applicable. We argued it to the nth degree in our dispositive motions before the district court, but yet it wasn't even mentioned in their initial brief. Not a footnote, not a mention whatsoever. And I think that also yields support to the fact that speaks volumes, rather, to the fact that their arguments are without support and are substantially without merit. Thus, as this court has warned, necessitating a finding that sanctions are appropriate. Arbitration awards are supposed to be an expedient remedy. It's supposed to be quick. It's supposed to be fast. If you look at the procedural history here, there was a grievance filed in May. There was a hearing in July. There was July 17th. There was a decision the very next day, and that was July 18th, 2006. Here we are, April 2010, still hearing new arguments and arguing things that were never at least raised in the district court as well. Your Honor, we could address a number of other issues that we raised arguendo in our brief, but I don't think that would be a good use of this court's time. I'd like to close with a discussion regarding the material facts and how there are no material facts in dispute. The material facts here relate to whether an agreement was signed, and those are undisputed, very clear. The fact that Parkland acknowledges, for example, that they agree they had a duty to arbitrate. They just don't agree on how long that duty to arbitrate lasted. The district court, for example, clearly indicated that there was no dispute as to whether or not there was a core agreement between the parties. Now, there's certainly disputes over how that agreement is to be applied, and there's certain disputes regarding the underlying grievance, but those are not material because they do not relate to whether or not there was an agreement to arbitrate. All the factual disputes identified by Parkland, particularly, for example, the date that the agreement was signed, even though that was admitted in pleadings, are all matters that were properly resolved by the arbitration and the CIB grievance committee. Lastly, I want to focus on the issue that Parkland discussed here today, which is the the first aspect of the arbitration award, that first decision, which says that Parkland is signatory to the agreement. And if you look at that, what the court really was doing, or what the arbitration panel was really doing in that circumstance, was they were rejecting Parkland's argument that it was a project-only agreement. They're saying you're signatory to the agreement. That wasn't determining their own jurisdiction. That was just rejecting Parkland's argument that it was a project-only agreement. And the district court picked up on this, I think it was on page 16 of their opinion. In closing, Your Honors, Local 477 requests that this court affirm the award because it is based on a well-reasoned decision that is based in turn on 40 years of jurisprudence supporting and favoring arbitration clauses, favoring labor arbitrations, and keeping those disputes out of this court. For all those reasons, we request that this court affirm the decision and likewise strongly consider an award of sanctions here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Mr. Mills, how much time does Mr. Mills have?
If there was anything frivolous about this case, it was the fact that they filed this grievance asking an arbitration panel to decide its own jurisdiction. There's a myriad of court cases saying arbitrability is a matter for the courts to decide, and that's in essence what the arbitration panel did. They said there is a contract. There's a Supreme Court case which was argued on January 17th called Granite Rock, which hasn't been issued yet, but it dealt with the same issue. In that case, the union wanted an arbitrator to decide whether or not there was a collective bargaining agreement in place, and who knows what the Supreme Court will decide, but it's exactly on point. First off, the U.S. Steel case that he talks about has nothing to do with this case. In that case, there was a contract in place, no dispute about that. There's a side agreement that the company would have a neutrality agreement, and this company went out and bought new plants, and there was a neutrality agreement in that particular case. And then the company got mad because they didn't like this and said that they weren't going to do this anymore. This court ruled that that was subject to arbitration. That was the scope they were talking about what all was included. This is simply saying there was no collective bargaining in place either at the time the Washington Street project was completed or after 6 months. And the Supreme Court is clear on this, that 301 doesn't have a statute of limitations, and therefore they were adopting the labor one from the National Labor Relations Act. And in the answer and the affirmative defense, we said ad nauseum there is no collective bargaining agreement in place, which as far as waiving any argument, that certainly doesn't waive this argument. 301 doesn't have a statute of limitations, but it does have this 6 month limitation that the Supreme Court and then a number of cases have followed forth with that. Secondly, the Buckeye check cashing case, which the judge relied on, again, has nothing to do with this case. In that case, it was a check cashing outfit made these guys sign an agreement for arbitrability, and in that particular case, they found that the amount was usurious, and the court said, well, that doesn't destroy the rest of the contract. And there was some language in there that has to do with attacking the arbitration clause, but in that case, they weren't attacking the arbitration clause. We are. We're saying there was no collective bargaining in place. They had 6 months to take action, and I've cited in my reply brief a decision in the Fifth Circuit, I believe it is, where they said that simply ignoring it is not a defense. After a reasonable time, if the union takes no action, and you're supposed to send in reports and other things, the union just ignored it for 2 years. And Mr. Stowers, there's a dispute, material dispute, and that Mr. Stowers thought he was signing a similar agreement to that of the White Oaks. Certainly he should have made it clear. I have written out for all of my clients an addendum that states this A through Z. But in this case, that was his understanding, and that's a factual dispute that needs to be decided, and that's not to be decided in a summary judgment. And also the question of arbitrability that they asked in the grievance for the arbitration panel to decide is to be decided by the courts. Again, in my reply brief, there is a myriad of cases which say that arbitrability is to be decided by the courts. You can't let an arbitrator decide whether or not they have jurisdiction. And Justice Ginsburg was even puzzled by this in the Granite Rock argument. She was saying, well, if you decide you don't have jurisdiction, what are you doing here? So I see my time's up. I would like to thank the court and ask the court to overturn the summary judgment decision. And also, I think there's sufficient grounds to overturn the arbitration panel's award. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Mr. Millison. Thanks to you, Mr. Long. Case will be taken under advisement.